Hello, everybody. This is Jake Senzio, host of the Jake and Gino podcast. Here, my co-host, the multifamily mentor, the coach, the chef, the father, six, best-selling author, the G Daddy, Gino Barber. Gino, how's it going?
Jake, it's going to be an amazing show as usual. I'm just going to hold up the book for everybody. We're going to be talking and diving into it. You may get a little uncomfortable in this one, Jake, because we're going to do a little life coaching. You're getting a little personal.
Don't ask me anything, Gino.
You better buckle up,
buttercup. I'll punch you, bro.
Virtually?
All right. So today's guest has worked with entrepreneurs all over the world, helping to break down their limiting beliefs and establish clarity. He continues to inspire and challenge individuals through his book, One Last Talk, for the folks on YouTube that just saw that from the G-Daddy. So without further ado, Philip McKernan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate being here.
It is our pleasure. Now, you've worked with entrepreneurs all over the world. What's the big difference that you've seen between the super successful to the average professional grinding in their 9 to 5?
Well, we've got to take a step back from that question, first of all, and contextualize the success a little bit, because I think
Gino always wants to massage it here.
I'm not, Philip. He just jumps right in. We haven't even started dating yet. And you ask the guy, just a little bit.
I thought this was going to be nice and relaxing and fun. Holy shit, I feel I'm on the spot.
Dude, you're a machine gun. Here comes machine guns, man. You said ask anything. I'm dropping A-bombs, baby. Let's go.
Machine gun Eddie here. I would just taking a step back and saying, okay, well, defining success, because it's not for me to define what success is for you or for any of your listeners or watchers in the future, but it's actually to take the time out to understand what success is for them as individuals. If you're talking about pure economic success, then I think a lot of people that I have experienced can achieve that from a slightly more negative place. In other words, they grew up poor and they're determined to be rich because they never want to experience the pain of the past. Is anything wrong with that? No, until it gets to a point where it passes a precipice where it becomes an unhealthy drive and an obsession rather than something they desire. But there's another type of, I suppose, newer entrepreneur that's emerging into the world, and that is one who is giving back to the world, wants to leave the world in a better place, is more mission driven. And my experience is when you focus on that, I do believe the corny cliche line that used to piss me off so much, when you do what you love, the money will follow. And I go, yeah, sounds great. Cause I've done lots of stuff I thought I loved and the money did not follow at all. But there's some immense truth to that. And I think if you focus on leaving the world in a better place, leaving your world in a better place, you'll end up attaching yourself to something that really is meaningful and it'll move the needle for you and for others in a more aggressive way. That to me is epically successful. And they're the most successful people I see on the planet today.
I'm going to blow this thing up right now because we got to really nail this down here, because what you just said, you've done things that you've loved and you've never worked in your life, but you thought that was bullshit. So I think we need to, this is such a famous quote that gets kicked around so much. I love fitness, exercising and whatever. So when I got out of college, I became a personal trainer, and it was the most miserable years of my life because people were whining and bitching. I don't want to do it. And I felt like some kind of therapist / gym teacher. It was terrible. So I think the thing that when you're looking at that quote that people need to understand is it's that when you're getting fulfillment from your work, to be more specific from it, when you're getting fulfillment from your work, it becomes fun. And then you reach a level of, I don't want to say elite or whatever the case may be, but you're damn good at it. And that success feels good. And you're able to give back. So it's not like, I love Pokemon cards, because I know like Gary Vee talks about this shit. That doesn't mean become like a Pokemon card trader. I think we just want to drill in on that. When you're becoming really good at something and it's fulfilling to you, that's when the shit gets interesting to me.
Yeah, when it moves the needle for others. I mean, we had a guy who was just in Ireland with me recently. And he's a professional dancer and he's danced at the highest level. In fact, I think he'd be brilliant for the show in the future if you want his name. But amazing guy. He loved dancing, turned it into a career, and began to slowly and surely resent the career of dancing, because he loved dancing, but it doesn't necessarily mean he needs to monetize it. So to me, it's this balance of, as you said, loving the work that you're doing and bringing that and adding value to the world. And I think that's a very, very special place to operate in many respects. But he ended up resenting it, and yet dance was the thing he loved. So it's not, as you said, the Pokemon thing. It's just finding something professionally you can do that you love and makes an impact in the world in a better way.
Philip, when did you realize you weren't a bad guy?
When did I realize I wasn't a bad guy? I would say that I'm 48 years old right now. I would say I began to believe that. I would say it to myself. I would use statements to try to convince myself that I wasn't a bad person. But I would say about 3-4 years ago, 5 years ago, I would start to actually believe that. I don't think there was a specific moment. But there was one or two things that happened in my life around that time where I said, you know what, you're not so bad, McKernan. You're not so bad.
Why did it take so long?
I think it's a fascinating question. No one's ever asked me either of those questions, particularly the first one. And I, the opening question was, you know, what some variation of what creates that success? You know, what's the one pattern you see in people? I think one of the greatest patterns I see in every, it permeates every human being I've ever worked with, is they don't have a very high opinion of themselves. They don't actually like who they are. And sometimes they use that harshness to drive themselves, to batter themselves, to beat themselves. It took me so long because I think I spent a very, very long time truly believing I wasn't a good person. When I was back as far as when I was in school, I mean, I was told I was stupid, I was lazy, I would amount to nothing. So I think I heard a lot of early voices from people that I looked up to in society. And I started to believe what they said. Certain things I did in my own life that I'm not proud of, that kind of validated this internal feeling that I'm not good enough and I'm not a good person. And then I think I was very reluctant to do the inner work that was required to shift the needle in that regard and to forgive. I started to forgive everyone in the world, but I never got to forgive myself, which I finally started to address in the latter part of my life. And that has been very, 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 very effective for me.
What was that feeling like when your name wasn't on that rugby team list? It's on there and then it wasn't on there. How was that feeling?
Yeah, that was astonishing. And I don't think it would have affected many people the way it affected me. I just think when you didn't have anything else to grasp onto, when you know, home life was challenging, you were being bullied, you were stupid, according to the teachers, you were dyslexic, you couldn't read, you couldn't write, and you're picked for a rugby team when it kind of wasn't expected. It was just like that greatest high in my life. It was just like, oh my God, you know, all of this pain has been worth it. All of this uncertainty, all of this discomfort. Somebody does see the value in me. And then to walk up to that notice board that day in school and to see that name being removed in the most public manner. I'm not sure I've ever experienced a feeling like that before. And I hope I never experience a feeling like that again. And I came close a couple of times professionally when the Canadian Olympic team asked me to work with them. But then they came back to me and said, we can't officially call you part of the team because you're not a sports psychologist. So I've had a couple of those mini setbacks, but they've affected me a lot less. So just a sense of worthlessness, because it wasn't about the sport. It was about being part of something. That's what it was for me.
We interviewed Nurial, and one of his quotes that really sticks with me is, our perception of who we are changes what we do. If you perceive yourself as being someone that was not a good person, how did that affect you professionally, personally? And then what happened once you made that shift? I felt the same way. I was working at a restaurant. I'm the pizza guy. I can't help anybody. It took years for me to find out what I truly love to do. And by the way, anyone thinking of getting into education, trying to monetize it, good luck. It's going to take you 3, 4, 5 years. And you're not getting into education to monetize. You're getting into education for the greater good, for your sole purpose, to help others out, to really, and that's hard when you're trying to make the money and trying to pay the bills. Don't get into education unless you know that you're out there impacting others and helping others and getting on 500 podcasts and not making a nickel from them, but having the ability to talk to Philip McKernan. I wouldn't have this ability if it wasn't for Jake and Gino. So it's not everything in life is about monetizing. It's really about truly going towards your sole purpose and trying to live that life of abundance. But you can't if you think you're a terrible person. You can't if you think you're not worthy of it. So could you just comment on that quote for me? Because to me, it's really impactful.
Yeah, I think deep down, the best way I can describe that is, and hopefully this will make some sort of sense, you can have the, you know, leave aside whether we believe in vision boards or not. Leave aside, I'm just using it as an idea, as a concept, mm-hmm. to make a point. You can have a vision board next to your bed and you can wake up every single morning and swing your legs out onto the floor and land on the floor and stare at that vision board and give yourself affirmations, close your eyes, feel into all the things around the vision board. And you can tell yourself intellectually that you not just deserve those things, but you will achieve those things. But here's what happens. And this is why a lot of people don't understand why their actions or inactions contradict the very things they want in life. And they go, what is wrong with me? Well, there's nothing wrong with you. What the problem is, you haven't dealt with those internal demons that are determined to pull you down, determined to show you how bad you are in this world or show you you're undeserving. So the bottom line is, you're looking at this vision board. You say, yeah, I want the yacht. Yes, I want the impact. Yes, I want to build this orphanage. Yes, I want this man or woman in my life. Yes, I want these kids. But every step you take after that moment into the world and around the world, you seek to validate how you feel about yourself. It's not what you think. And that's why I do have a challenge with mindset in its entirety. Mindset's important, But I believe in soul, what I call soul set, this internal feeling we have towards yourself, leaving aside what we think we want intellectually. So if I haven't dealt with the things I'm ashamed of, if I haven't dealt with the things that have hurt me deep down, they're the things that are operating. I'm actually the puppet. And these things are pulling the strings. They're controlling me more than I can imagine. Therefore, that's why sabotage comes in. That's why people blow money. That's why people blow relationships. That's why people blow dreams and aspirations, and they wonder why that has happened and they haven't got to the core of it.
I had a coaching call with a girl last night, young woman, Jennifer Brown. She was afraid of putting in LOIs. I said, why are you afraid? She's like, they may say yes. And then I've got to do
that's the best answer I've ever heard in my life.
And I sat there and I'm saying, well, I get it on a couple of coaching calls with my wife, who's a life coach. I said, that is very challenging. I mean, like, you're sort of self-sabotaging yourself. So you're not putting in these LOIs and not doing the work, although you want to get into multifamily. So there's a deeper issue going on there. Maybe the fact that she's a woman and she says multifamily is not for her. So I got to dive in deeper with that. So I thank you for that answer. That's an amazing answer.
But to go back though, how did you deal with the inner demons though? So you've identified them. I think that's probably a great first step, but how personally did you attack those?
Well, I mean, you know, inner demons, I mean, obviously depending on what they are, but everybody that I've ever met has been, has experienced a degree of trauma, some more severe in societal terms than others. And a lot of people would sit there and go, no, I haven't had any serious trauma. I mean, you know, my friend John has and my cousin Mary, but me, I haven't really. I mean, it wouldn't be traumatic. And then you get them to talk about their life and they've had incredible trauma in their life. They just haven't necessarily allowed themselves to experience it. So to me, it's about shining a light on the things that we're aware of that have held us back, aware of that have hurt us, aware of that sabotage us. And then there's always these things that we haven't actually thought about. And I'll give you a very obscure example of this. Is my wife left, they lived in Scotland for a number of years and they moved from Scotland back to Ireland. And on the surface, this is almost bordering on silly. This is almost like, oh, for God's sake, you've obviously married somebody who's very dramatic in life and seeking attention and isn't, you know, whatever. And they, as a young child, they forgot her, what we call a little pram, which is a pushchair for her doll. They forgot this pushchair. And my wife told me about this only about 5 or 6 years ago, approximately. Let's just say I was about 40 years old. She was 40 years old. And she started talking about this. And I asked her a few questions. Before you know it, she's bawling her eyes out. And you're thinking, okay, what? So it's not the thing that happened. It's like what it represented. Mm-hmm. So then you go back to understand, okay, what did it represent? And what essentially represented was she was one of 7 children and they had very little money. And what ended up happening was she only had 2 things in her world. At that time, possessions with things that are meant a lot to her, the doll and the pushchair. And the fact that the parents forgot the pushchair was no big deal in itself, except she internalized that is they don't care enough to bring the 2 things that I love and need in this world. They don't care enough about me. And when you're trying to find significance in amongst 7 kids, you don't need a lot of signposts to show that you're not, regardless of the truth or not. It devastated her and it affected her for years. But where that begins to play out is then you try to feel and find significance in other areas. Then you make a solemn promise to yourself, I'm never going to do that to my kids. I'm never not going to have money. So she then decided to become an accountant. And this is a very relevant story because we had a little brief chat before about some of your client base and everything else. So we go back to why she picked being an accountant. The career guidance person in school said, you're good with numbers. Your sister's an accountant and she's making good money and you can escape this environment. That wasn't horrifically bad, but it was painful. She put 1 and 1 and 1 together as an accountant, came up with 7 and thought this was going to solve her life. She became an accountant. She was miserable. She went into industry. She went into private practice. She hated it all. She's the worst accountant in the world because she was
that's me.
She's the worst. She was never destined to be an accountant. And a lot of it, not all of it, stems back to these little stories that have big significance, but we never take the time to acknowledge and to understand. And you take one of those stories, multiply those by 10 of these little stories, how they frame and influence and begin to form who we are around money and real estate and deserving. So you're sitting next to somebody at one of your conferences and they've got 100 doors and you're thinking, Jesus, hope they don't ask me how many doors I have. I've got 7 in my house, but I don't own anything outside of my house.
That's such a true scenario there that you just painted, though. Gino, think about that. Like, people coming in for the first time and they're sitting next to somebody and that person probably just posted on Facebook, just closed 300 units. And you're sitting there saying, but guys, they started somewhere. That's the thing you got to understand. They didn't start with 300 units. They didn't start with 100 units. We all start somewhere. Yeah. It's okay.
Do you know the movie Trains, Planes, and Automobiles?
I haven't heard of it. Don't remember it. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know what's the actors in Trains, Planes, and Automobiles?
Fat dude. Old
John
dude.
Candy.
Yes.
Steve Martin.
Yes. The jerk. Yes.
Who's the third?
I can't remember the third.
Because there is no third. Except this goes right back to your point. Except there is a young Kevin Bacon at the very beginning of the movie that doesn't say one single word. He's in it for about 8 seconds in the movie. People don't look at the Kevin Bacon then. They look at the Kevin Bacon later in his career. Okay, maybe.
He's been in every movie.
Yeah, exactly. But they go, I want to be Kevin, but I want to be this guy. They don't realize he started somewhere. He started with a part that he didn't even get to speak in. He started in a shitty movie that he wished he never made. He started in a nude scene that he wished he could buy the rights back to. And he made all these movies until he got his first break. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing we got to remember in real estate or anywhere else in life is you've got, I work in professional sports, and a lot of these young lads compare themselves and aspire to be somebody, but sometimes that aspiration becomes unhealthy where they start to lack belief, which is a huge component in any type of success, that they can actually do it, that they're intelligent enough, smart enough, deserving enough to actually do it.
Is that ego holding them back, though? Is that they just think very highly of themselves and they're worried that because someone else has achieved more success, so their
fixed
ego
mindset. It's sort of remember the fixed mindset where you've been always great at what you do, then you have a challenge in life, and all of a sudden that challenge is hard. You're like, I'm gonna quit, I'm out, because you are always the gifted person. Whereas the growth mindset is, I don't have any doors, but I'm gonna figure it out, because if Jake and Gino, the two jabronis, can do it, I can do it. And they figure out the growth mindset and they keep working on it. And they know they're gonna do nude scenes. They know they're gonna be on a film for 8 seconds.
Whoa,
but that's okay. That's part of the.
You know, what'd it take for you to get into real estate?
All it took was to meet you, my friend. That's all it took. You say the greatest gift lies next to our greatest pain. Can you just dive into that for a little bit, Philip?
Yeah. So, I mean, I suppose I've experienced this myself personally, but I've also seen this in a more exaggerated way through the One Last Talk movement. And that is, often it's the very things that we have gone through that have hurt us the most, have the most power to support us growing, but also helping others. And behind, and I hopefully I'm saying this very respectfully, because I'm not speaking for you, but I think behind any human that is doing meaningful work, I think if you track it back deep enough, I think that the holy grail for me in terms of impact is when you take the very thing that you struggled with the most and you bring that to the world to help other people eradicate that in their life or fast track through that process in their own life. I get the feeling from you guys that it's not just about real estate and money, that the real estate is a vehicle so you guys can have a certain degree of freedom, that you can spend more time with your family, that you can impact the world, you can have some fun along the way, or make fun of each other along the way. I'm not sure which, or maybe both.
One and the same.
The very things that have hurt us the most is the thing we often stay away from and the thing we shy away from. And the thing with One Last Talk, it's just one place. It's not the only place in the world, but it's one place where we've asked people to get on a stage in life, not necessarily at an event, and share their one last talk, and to share the thing that they're probably least proud of, the world almost knows nothing about, in the hope that they free themselves and they give somebody across the room or across the country the permission to say, oh my God, I'm not alone. And if that man has the courage, or that woman has the courage, to stand there and talk about sexual abuse, loss of their child, going into bankruptcy, giving up a professional sport and not having anything and being lost, if that gives them a sense of relief, I guarantee you the ripple effect will allow other people to feel the same and to feel a degree of normality. But it frees them of that shackles. It frees them of that story and that pain and allows them to live in a different way. So that's why I say that your greatest pain lies right next to your deepest wound. And I think it's very, very true.
Well, Philip doesn't like to promote himself, but I sure as hell will, because it's an amazing book. dive into it. There's a lot of great stories in here. Why did you call it One Last Talk, and what does it comprise?
So I was disenchanted by many of the events that I was speaking at myself, whereby, you know, there was endless amounts of gurus standing on stage sharing and telling you how you should live your life. And in some respects, if not many respects, they themselves not necessarily living by that, which might sound very unprofessional to say that publicly, but that's my experience.
Not at all. No. Because we've spoke to a lot of people on this show and things like that. And sometimes we're either like, damn, that was a cool person, or whoa, what a weirdo that was. Like, you never know, because there's this whole facade persona that these people put out to the world, and sometimes it's not true, and sometimes it is. You know, you just gotta kind of get to know the person long enough to see if it's real or not. So I think I welcome that. Yeah.
So that was my experience, and the other one was also I wanted the people who would ordinarily sit in the audience to be on the stage. I wanted them to feel that they had a voice, that they had a message, that they had a gift, that they had a story. They could heal other people. They could help other people. And the very first lady, I won't get into too much detail, but the very first lady was a first speaker ever at a One Last Talk event was Bev. And Bev is, I know she won't mind me saying, but 5 foot nothing. She's tiny. And but she shared about how what happened when her son committed suicide. And I'll never forget that event to the day I die. I'll never forget that moment. And I was all prepared, had all my notes and all my follow-up questions. I literally got my pad at one point and I threw it across the room. And I said, right, what are you going to do as a parent as a result of what Bev has just shared with the world? And the reason she shared it at the very end, she didn't go into this lecture about, now you should do this and you should do that. All she said at the end, if I could turn back the clock. Because if she had lectured them and pointed, we have a lot of people telling us how we should live our life. You know, far too many corners we turn. We've been told what we should and believe or do or be and everything else. And she just said, if I could turn back the clock, I would stop caring as much as I did about his academic results. I would care less about, you know, making money in the way I did because she didn't enjoy it. I would tell him I loved him more, and I would have put my phone away more, and I would have hugged him, I think she said. And I'm just like, I still can't tell the story without feeling the emotion. And
it gives you chills just thinking about it, because we all screw up and make these mistakes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then people just got up and said, I said, what are you going to do? Now, what are you going to think about? What are you going to say? I'm going to bring my daughter on a date. I'm going to do this. And then she looked at me, and I promised her that I would have her back. Because she said to me 10 times, I'm not doing this talk. I'm not a One Last Talk speaker. I've never spoken in front of a human in my life. There was 150 people in the room. And that day changed her for the rest of her life, because it was the first time she truly saw the passing of her son as even a remote gift to humanity, that there's a possibility that it will help others with suffering. And it was the first time that her other boy got his mum back. Because when she lost her son, when she lost her son and her son lost his brother, he lost his mom as well, mm-hmm. because she was so devastated. And their relationship came back in a way that she can't even comprehend, because I've spoken to her about it. And that was the power of her sharing that for the first time, even though she was deeply ashamed about it.
Questions for Jake.
Well, you're asking me a question?
No, this question is for Jake.
Okay.
It's about vulnerability. And sometimes the man in pink over there, who's wearing pink, does not like to get vulnerable. He doesn't like to go back and tell some stories about how he left his job and how he's had struggles, because, you know, big tough guy. And I get it.
Oh, we don't roasted it right now.
Well, you're roasting me. I got to roast back, bro. You know what I'm saying? and talk about how important vulnerability is, because vulnerability, transparency, we're all normal. We're all human. We all make mistakes. We put our people that we love on a pedestal. And that's not always the case.
It's a big question. I mean, to me, vulnerability has become this kind of sexy thing where I've seen an increasingly more and more speakers in the world become vulnerable. And to me, I'm not saying they're acting entirely. What I'm saying is that they're seeing it as a way to connect with the audience.
Yes.
And it's being used in a very
manipulative way.
Manipulative way, to be honest with you. And you can smell it a mile away when someone is telling a story to try to be vulnerable and they're not. And I don't want to throw them under the bus, because maybe they're trying, maybe they're doing their best, maybe they truly want to, but they haven't done the internal work to actually connect with the emotion without being in their, this is why we stay here in their head and our intellect, is because we want to protect ourselves ultimately deep down, without getting into too much detail about that. Where vulnerability, in my personal opinion, becomes the absolute best possible, not tool, but invitation, particularly in parenting, And I'll give you the quickest example of this. My daughter was, we were living in Boulder, and my daughter went across the road and she was hanging out with her little friend and a beautiful girl. And they, one day anyway, she came to Charlie, my daughter, Maggie, she's 10. She came to Charlie, who's our 12-year-old son. And she said, Charlie, I might be getting in trouble because we filled all the mailboxes on this part of the street with rocks. And, you know, she said, what do you think I should do? And he said, tell dad. And why he said, tell dad, is we had a kind of a family game of truth, which wasn't part of a plan. And this is about 4 months earlier, 3 months earlier. And I started sharing stuff to the point where my wife is like, I can't believe you're sharing that shit that I did. And my kids were laughing. They're going, oh my God, dad, I can't believe you did that and whatever. And anyway, fast forward to this incident where she's talking to my son. And she goes, but I can't tell dad. She says, of course you can. Do you remember all the stuff that dad did? He'll have no problem with this type of thing.
I love it.
And the two of them came to me. He brought her and she had her head down and she shared. It was no big deal. And but it's a silly example and a very minor example in the context of when your parent, like the one thing I'll say to parents is play a sport with your kids or a game with your kids that you're shit at, that you're disastrous at. But a lot of parents don't do that because they want to be able to show their kids they can win. But in actual fact, what we're doing then is we're inadvertently, and when we don't show emotion, when we don't argue at home, when we don't allow our kids to see our pain, when my kids are not allowed to see what not being picked on that rugby team was like, what they do is they put me on a pedestal. They make me inhuman. And what that becomes is the aspiration and the benchmark for the way they need to be in the world and the person they need to find to journey in this world with. But they don't exist because they just don't exist unless they marry a robot from the Toshiba plant or the, you know, some place in Japan. I do believe there's a wonderful opportunity to be vulnerable with their own children, to show us that we're not perfect and therefore create the platform for their imperfections to be shared. And that's been my experience. If there's one thing, I don't do many things as a parent well. I don't consider myself the parent I want to be. But if there's one thing I do brilliant as a parent is we create an environment of vulnerability at home. That's one thing we do exceptionally well.
Three quick stories, guys. Just really quick on what Phil's talking about. Last night, I played Barbies with the 7-year-old. Haven't played Barbies in a while. I suck at playing Barbies. I mean, the imagination coming out of her. I want to get toy soldiers and tanks. I can't do that. But she wants to play Barbie. And I felt vulnerable because I'm like, what do you want to do? We're moving from one house to a bigger house. I'm like, Laura, are we going to sell the house or rent it out? She could care less. I'm trying to like put some financial knowledge. The second one. Play tennis with your kids. I want to kick my daughter's butt, but she's really good. And she's at a point where she can almost beat me and she smells it. She smells blood and water. And number three, play chess with your kids. I was really good at chess. All of a sudden, I'm almost a little embarrassed to play because they kick my ass now. And I feel really crappy. But at the same time, I have that competition. And the fourth story, we're all singing opera right now. And I've been told I've got a lovely velvety voice, but my kids are a lot better than me right now. And I'm driving to get better, to be as competitive as them.
You're trying to catch up right now.
but I enjoy it. And we're doing it because of the family. And I was pushed into opera singing. And it's been an amazing endeavor. I love it. It's really gotten the family closer. But it's okay that I suck and they're really good because I'm really proud of them. But it's important that we are vulnerable. And the biggest thing you can say to your kids is I'm sorry. I've been saying I'm sorry for the last few years. And that's really hard for adults. We make mistakes. Your kids are right sometimes. Be vulnerable and say sorry to them because they do deserve it. And when your kid does put rocks in the mailbox, I'd probably join them. But they're going to come to you first before they come to their friends or before they go to Instagram. They're going to come to you and talk about what they did. So that's truly, truly important.
Yeah. I do that with clients all the time. And we say all the time, there's points and, you know, I won't do it every day, but my clients, I mean, the first person to burst into tears at Brave Soul as an event I run was me. And the reason for that, this is about a month ago. And the first question was, we're sitting in the room, we're having just a welcome drink. And someone says, so what's it like to be running your first event in Ireland after being away from events for over 2 years because of the pandemic? And I start to just say, I'm just so grateful. And I just burst into tears. Now, I would have been really embarrassed by that a number of years. I would have retained that. I would have controlled that emotion. And when I say embarrassed, they weren't the super messy tears, but I let it out. And I don't care what they thought. That's not the point. Because I was so grateful. I missed live events, that human connection, like you wouldn't believe, because that's my special place. That's the place that I come alive more than anywhere else in the world. And I'd say that I would speak on behalf of most of them. I would say that they appreciate the fact that I don't stand there pretending I've got my shit together and I'm perfect. It allows them to access the work without that judgment or self-judgment. And I think it's a more powerful place.
Before we get to the short answers, how does one listening to this discover their one last talk?
So leave the book aside. I would ask anybody to write a one last message if you were about to die. And I think, by the way, death is not to be morbid. Death is to help us frame. Death is to help us give us a little bit of focus to help us be a little bit more urgent. And the power of what one last talk to me is not just theater. Mm-hmm. To me, it's about helping us understand who we are as a human. Because when you have to sit down and define what it is that you would say in a one last message, I would then ask them to go from there and write a one last letter. And they go, okay, well, what's the directions? Well, what's the 15 steps? I go, no. We're not going to over-prescript this to you or over-prescribe this to you, because that's part of the problem. Because ultimately, you write the letter we want you to write. You get a piece of paper off your computer and you've got 15 minutes to write the one last letter you'll ever write. Who would you write it to and what would you say? And the only thing we ask is you're not allowed to lecture anybody. Now, kids don't have unprotected sex and don't take drugs. And that's not, they don't need that. They've already had that from you. What is the one thing that you want to write into the world and say to a specific human being? And then finally, if you're up for it, create a one last talk and share that story and at least share it with one other human being. And it's a very simple process. And everybody that's ever done a one last talk has found it very, very, sometimes very difficult and challenging. They all say they would have gone deeper after the fact if they could go back and do it. I would highly recommend that people do it at events, do it with their families, do it whatever, because it knits people together. We ran it at a conference. We ran it in companies. It's probably one of the greatest tools to bring people, connect people together as human to human, and then layer in the information and the education on top of that. And what you learn about yourself is remarkable. That's my experience. You'll find out what's really important when all is said and done. And we ask people to have the conversation. I often find one of the greatest questions out there is, what's the most important conversation you're simply not having? And at any given time, every human being has multiple conversations that they're simply not having with their loved ones, with themselves, with their colleagues. And if we could clear some of those up, I think we would all live a more fulfilling, peaceful life. That's my experience.
Hey guys, let's take a quick time out to hear from our sponsor.
Are you looking for ways to improve your life?
Here at Jake and Gino, our mission is to empower students through financial education and the vehicle of multifamily investing.
Yes, Jake. We agree that a person with financial intelligence can change the world for the better.
We've created our proprietary three-step framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right, that we teach to our community. This framework, along with education, our one-on-one mentorship, on-site boot camps, and the amazing community, has propelled our students to massive success.
We've all been there. We've had so many students that have been able to shift their mindset, overcome limiting beliefs, and set a clear path to achieve their goals. Whether you're currently fixing and flipping, wholesaling, or buying single-family rentals, and you know that multifamily investing is the right vehicle for you, I encourage you to visit jakeandgino.com/apply to schedule your complimentary consultation with our team. And I want to let you know, this isn't a high-pressure sales call. It's really just a discovery call to get to know each other better and see if we're a good fit for working together. And if for any reason we're not a good fit, our team has tons of resources we will share with you to help you along your journey.
If you're ready to stop spinning your wheels, go to jakeandgino.com/apply and schedule your call now.
All right, so we're back. I want to unpack this a little bit more. The one last talk. What is it doing for folks? Is it liberating them? Is it you know, allowing them more inner peace? Like, what are some of the results that you see from it?
Yeah, great question. We had a professional soccer player who played in the Bundesliga in Germany, probably arguably the second biggest league in the world. His name was Rob Friend. He played for Mönchengladbach, finished his career in LA Galaxy. When Rob took the stage, he shared how he missed football. He had never verbalized. The perception is, you've made your millions, you played at the highest level, you never need to work another day in your life, you're happy, you're set. Truth is, that's not the case. The truth is that he really struggled assimilating back into society. And therefore, the perception was challenged for people. For him personally, what it allowed him to do was to verbalize the pain, the discomfort, how much he missed football in a way that he wouldn't have done because of his ego. It asked him to remove the ego, albeit temporarily, perhaps, to share his truth. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He says, I never thought I would feel the feeling that I would get when I walked out in front of 70,000 people and scored a goal in the final. And he said, I just got it today. And what was also interesting that day was I'll never forget the day. There was 150 people in the room or so. And I said, raise your hand if you're a professional soccer player. No one. Raise your hand if you've just retired from professional sport. No one. So therefore, this talk is a complete waste of time. And everyone laughed and people were going, I can't believe you just said that. And I said, unless, of course, you're an entrepreneur who has just said goodbye to their business, unless you're a mother or father who said goodbye to their children, unless it is, and I contextualize it back to their lives. So people get different things from it, depending on the talk they give, their willingness to go deeper. But there's a lightness and a freedom that is achieved by it. And no one's asked me this question before, but actually, if I sum it up in one, I could sum it up like this. It's a sense of matter. I matter now. A sense of value. I can't believe I've given a talk and it's impacted another human being. Mm-hmm. I never imagined I could do that, particularly with my own personal story. A 10-step strategy, how to, buy Bitcoin. They would see that all day long. But like, how could me sharing a part of my personal story affect somebody in a positive way? And a sense of worthiness that comes from that. And you can't quantify that. There's no way to quantify what that means to somebody.
The suppression that society places on us to bury these things is real. And I think one thing we always attempt to do, Gino, myself, is that if we're struggling with something, and it's typically, real estate or business related, and it sounds stupid or it seems like common sense, we try to bring that to the surface. Because if I'm struggling with something, there's some other person that's probably going through the same shit. But so many times, because it's interpersonal, we squash that stuff down. So I think you're freeing people. It's just interesting, the domino effect, though, because not only is it liberating that person and expanding their mind and the way they're viewing the world, they're also helping someone else. So it's this kind of crazy domino effect that's taking place here. It's really fascinating.
Can I just add one other thing to that? And please, it's based on the brief conversation we had before the call, before we went live, so to speak. And that was, you don't need to be a multimillionaire to do a one last talk. You don't need to have 100 doors, as we talked about, to do a one last talk. And to me, I think I used to be very frustrated by this, but I think that I'm more saddened by it. And now I'm even more thrilled at the idea of challenging people on this. Is there's a perception sometimes that when you make enough money, then you can go make an impact.
Yes.
And, we made a film called, a documentary called Give and Grow. And the whole idea is that when you give unconditionally of yourself, primarily in a non-financial way, giving of yourself. And when we used to do these trips every year, we'd bring a group of people to an orphanage, whether it's Peru, India, Africa, whatever, different countries. And they say, oh, how many gifts do we bring? And how many cases of stuff we're bringing? Not bringing anything, you're not allowed. We're not allowing you, forget about the orphanage. And we would contribute on occasion, and we actually end up building one down there, et cetera. But we would ask them to come down and just be themselves. And when they'd arrive at the orphanage, they're going like, but I don't have a Spanish dictionary to try to communicate with the kids, and I don't have a box of toys, and then suddenly they start to realize the kids don't give a shit. The kids want a hug.
We'll give a hug. Yeah,
I was going to say. Held. Yes. They want to laugh. They want to play. And I'll always remember that. This, I don't know why I'm sharing that. I don't think I've ever shared this publicly before. But I remember the last day in the orphanage in Guatemala. And there was two girls who were in wheelchairs. And I remember they were ignored because they would just sit there like this. And they would literally, the drool would come out of the side of their faces. And they would look up like this every now and again. And by 3 days in this orphanage, right, they were laughing. I'm not exaggerating. They were kind of slapping us and hitting us and chasing after us. They'd never seen them so engaged. And the last day, we had this kind of ceremony, this going away thing. And I said, where are the two girls? And they said, oh, they're sleeping or something. But there was a bullshit answer. And I said, well, we're not doing it. And they said, what do you mean? I said, we're not doing anything until those two girls. Now, I'm a pretty easygoing guy until I'm not. And I said, I don't give a shit. We're not doing anything until those two girls are sitting in this room. We went upstairs and they were sitting in, excuse the directness, in their own piss and shit, ignored for like 4 or 5 hours. And they were back in that kind of vegetated state again. And we insisted they got showered, dressed, cleaned up, whatever. And they came down. And I know for certain that the reason those kids came alive is because we loved them for those 3 or 4 days. Mm-hmm. That's all they needed. And clients walked away going, I always thought you needed money to make a difference. And in fact, the last thing I'll say in this is
that can be the lazy route.
Exactly. But actually, I think what's slightly detrimental, this is going to be a weird thing to say, when you hear a billionaire, and no disrespect, it's brilliant, finally realize that money isn't going to buy the happiness in isolation, and they decide to give their fortune to whatever charity or multiple charities, it's great in a way. But here's the downside of that. The downside of that is when Peggy or John, who are aspiring to buy their first door and dream about buying their first multifamily building or whatever, and they're sitting there going, we want to make a contribution because, God, how is our $250 going to make a difference? You see such and such just donated $4 billion or whatever
same,
it is.
It's same thing, yeah.
And it's what happens is we're pushing in a way we're given this idea that unless you've got billions, you can't make an impact. And I think that's a tragedy.
Since 2006, I had the fortune to go down to Harlem, to St. Joseph's Friary for Thanksgiving. And we go down every year for, I would work at the restaurant in the morning, then I'd go down and we would cook for the neighborhood, single resident occupants, started out with 150 people. And I would go down there. And to me, these people are drug addicted. They're poor. They don't eat well. I was able to cook these turkeys. My kids are all serving on the line, penne vodka, string beans, mashed potatoes. I mean, it was just amazing. And we've been doing that for the last 15 years. We weren't able to do it this year because of COVID. But what Philip says is absolutely 100% true, because you're able to sit down with them. They've never had a freaking turkey that delicious. And there's love in the food. And they can feel the energy of my family. And they can feel the energy of the Friars. And that room is transformed. What did that cost me? $500 and working a few extra hours and being tired. That's how I started. Then I wrote a cookbook for the Friars, highlighting all that. And then I was able to do it. I've donated more this past year than I've done my entire life as far as money, but that's not the point. It doesn't matter how much money you donate. It's about your time and about the love that you put into it. Because every year they want the Barbo family to come there. I would bring little bowls of lentil soup to Mary down there. And I bring some little things of cheesecake to them because they don't have that. And that's how you show true love. And that's how you connect with people. And that is something that I want my kids to see. Now my daughter's 22 years old. She's a missionary at Life Team. And I think it's rubbed off on her. And I want her to continue that. It's really about going out there and connecting and helping others. And to me, I miss that Thanksgiving. We do it for the 4th of July as well. There's some crazy people down there, guys talking to squirrels. And it's just amazing what you see in these neighborhoods, but you're there. And it didn't even feel like Thanksgiving, like a holiday to us, because we're so insulated from
this. You know, that squirrel might be talking back, bro. You don't know it. So maybe you're the one missing out. All right.
That's what I'm saying. I'm just like, there's insanity. There's so much. But when you go down there and you show them what family is supposed to be like, what caring is supposed to be like, and you give them something that they don't have, it's just an amazing connection. And that money, there's no amount of money that can buy that kind of love and that kind of happiness for them, as well as for my family, because we're getting something back in return. We're getting the fact that we can impact others and help others and, you know, be benefactors to others. So,
yeah. And I love the fact of giving back to maybe, you know, communities or places that perhaps intuitively we wouldn't necessarily always think about. I mean, we don't need to get into it, but I did ran one last talk in a prison, in a pretty high security prison in the States. And I thought I'd seen it all in terms of growth and whatever, which of course I haven't, but that was probably one of the greatest eye openers that I've ever experienced, to watch, you know, I think it was 7 men, some of which had committed murder, give their one last talks was harrowing and extraordinary. And I got a lot of judgment for it. And quite frankly, I didn't care. We had to do it when I met these men and we talked about the concept and they agreed to do the one last talk. And the way they gave the one last talks, it was staggering. It was staggering. And the healing that happened in the prison, it was incredible.
From a, you know, I guess maybe potentially a legacy, maybe the wrong term, but what have you seen people doing physically with their one last talks? They write them out. Are they filing them away so their family can see this in the future? Is it something that they're physically utilizing the talk to, you know, pass it down to their kids so maybe their family can understand them better, you know, when they pass? I'm just curious because it seems like there's something there to at least discuss.
Yeah. So it's a great question. So that has been the case for some of them. Sometimes they recorded it and put it away. So it can be, you know, held as a family, you know, I suppose document or document in some capacity. The other thing we also did is we worked, I believe, has Tucker Max been on your show?
Yes.
Yeah. So Tucker, so we ended up doing a one last book workshop whereby people got to write their one last book. And ironically, just within the last week, we had, I have two books sent to me from somebody in the States, somebody in Canada, very gracefully acknowledging the work we did or whatever. But the most important thing is this was their one last book. And it's the book, if you never, you know, ever wanted to write a book, and sometimes we get caught up in the book that we think will sell or the book that we think we should write. But if it was your one last book, what would you write about? And often it's a quite a different book. And one guy wrote about coming out as being homosexual to his wife, to his children, and to the world. And when I rang him about this one last book workshop, he said, what are you talking about? And he did one last talk, and that gave him the confidence to step into doing the book. He's just written.
Wait, he was trying to get a take back?
Yeah, what's that?
He was trying to get a take back on it or no?
What's a take back?
Like he wrote the book and then he said, no, that's not true. Like because he was struggling with it.
Sorry. The context, I should have said this, but he did the one last talk first. Yes. I should have said that. And then he wrote the one last book. So when I asked him to do the one last talk first, he said, holy shit, never going to do that. I'm not a speaker. And then I rang him about the one last book workshop.
Oh man, I thought you got stuck with like someone that was like, I can't go through this. It's like,
that's a
wild story in itself if that was the case. My. Just want to go back for a second here. When you were talking about struggling with personal, maybe self-esteem, not feeling that you were a good person, you've obviously had success in your life. And we didn't touch on guilt. Was guilt in that mix? And was that part of it? Or was it other things going on there? Because I just love to hear, you know, personally what you're going through.
He was born Irish Catholic. There's always guilt when you're Irish.
Let him answer the questions, you know.
As we say, but guilt is, I often say the Irish invented three things, the rain, Guinness, and guilt. So guilt permeates so much of who we are in this country. And I think guilt is so present and in so many different human beings, regardless of where they're at. I mean, I work with a lot of very successful entrepreneurs who pride themselves on taking Fridays off, for example. And I go, what do you do? And they sort of play golf or I sail or whatever. And I say, so how do you feel when you're on the golf course? Oh, well, I feel guilty I'm not in the office. So you may as well be in the office because, you know, the guilt is affecting your ability to be present and actually enjoy the process. To me, guilt is often present. Shame is present. Anger is present. Anger is a huge block in terms of moving forward in the world. My job is to shine a light and ask people to consider how present these things are in their lives, whether it's guilt, anger, or shame, and then begin to gently shine light on why it exists. Because we put these things down as just natural phenomena sometimes. And sometimes they are, but sometimes they're being contributed or fueled by incidences and things that have happened or not happened in their lives. And one thing I want to be very clear on, even when it comes to things like fear, people often say, how do you eradicate fear? So, well, good luck with that. And if that's your goal, number one is you'll never achieve it. And secondly is that the person who says that they have a four-step system to eradicating fear is lying to you.
Well, they're not living any longer at that point.
Well, exactly. But our job is to try to reduce it so it's not like, I love this idea.
Agree with that, but it's always going to be there. You're not going to, like, there's no magic pill you're going to take.
No, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. But it's about getting it to loosen its grip so it's not actually controlling you.
Agree.
And I'm beginning to accept the rest of it. And the same with guilt, the same with shame, that beginning to a sense of acceptance on this journey. And I think that's the problem. We want to hit the eject button and take all the negativity and we want to send it out into the stratosphere. And we don't want it to be in our bodies anymore. But these things are really powerful, very potent. They're in the deepest parts of who we are. So maybe I've worked with so many people who said, tell me about anger. No, I'm not angry. I used to be, but I went to therapy 20 years ago. I'm not angry. I said, great. Well, if you're not angry, you won't mind me asking you a couple of extra questions. At which point they get really fucking angry and they're angry at each rest of the questions. So they're angry. They're still angry. It's not gone. And the problem is when we think it's gone, we become complacent. That's the issue.
Well, don't you say in the book that most yoga instructors and people taking yoga are actually the most angriest people that you've met? I thought that was a little ironic and funny in the book.
Well, specifically about yoga teachers, yes. And I say this with love and respect, is that yoga and meditation, for that matter, I believe are two epic tools in this world to enhance our journey in this world. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that people often use those things to suppress or control emotion. Yes. And that's not, in my opinion, what it's for. And I jokingly said one day, I said, honestly, my experience is a lot of yoga teachers are really angry. And everyone burst into laughter. And people start going, "Oh shit, that's true," and it is actually my experience that quite a few yoga teachers and meditation teachers are quite angry.
Twist it up like a pretzel. It probably doesn't feel good, man. Yeah. Actually, I got to meet a yoga teacher. I don't know if I've ever met one. I got to find one here and check it out and see if that's true. I know we want to make sure though that if folks, you know, obviously after hearing this, they're going to want to pick up the book and learn more about you. So what's a good place for folks to go?
Best place is philipmckernan.com. That's my main website, and onelasttalk.com is a little bit more about the One Last Talk movement.
Philip, any books that you've read in the last few years or a book that really changed your life in a positive way that we can refer out to the folks?
I'm not a big reader because of my, I suppose, learning disabilities, but there is one book that, will come to my mind now. I'm a big fan of David White. He's a poet and a philosopher, but I love his work. So I can't remember the exact book, but if you just go look at davidwhite.com.
Check out some David White. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's really great. And there's another one. There is one called Anam Cara, written by a Irish philosopher called John O'Donoghue. You know, it's quite a deeper read, but it's very beautiful. And it's been
really Guilt, written. Reins, and Guinness or something like that.
Is that Guilt, Rain, and Guinness is the inventions of the Irish.
I gotcha. Oh, I thought it was the name of the book. Just messing with you. No, Gino, home here. Not. I know, I'm messing.
So Jake, young Philip McKernan is looking up at that board and he's seeing his name get stripped off, and the feeling of guilt and shame must have just overcome him. And in his own words, one of the worst moments of his life, and living through that and going through that professionally and then understanding that it wasn't him that was bad in school. He just had a learning disability. Then we look at it in a different way and going through all that and working through it and ultimately coming up and creating an amazing, I think, company, an amazing impact, and wanting to work with others and not trying to go out there and promote himself, but knowing that ultimately giving of yourself is one of the most important things and people will be gravitated towards you. And I have a couple calls to action for everybody on the call. CTAs, number one, buy the book. Number two, take out that piece of, as Philip said, computer paper. He's dating himself. Take out that piece of paper and start writing that one last talk. Mine would probably be something centered around my father. What an amazing man he was. Maybe I wish he would have shown love a little bit more. Maybe he could have said to me, you know, one of his last words, you know, instead of saying, you know, take care of your brother, instead of saying, could have said, I love you, Gino. He could have verbalized a little bit more. And that's, I take that, I internalize that. That's why with my kids, I want to have as many as I possibly can. If I only got six, I wish I could have more. I want to show the kids my love. I know my dad loved me in his way. And that was a challenge for me. And I was always looking at him and saying, am I doing what he wants me? And I understand his mom passed away at a young age. He didn't want me to make any mistakes. So his type of controlling, having that one restaurant, doing everything and, you know, being over me all the time and not having given me the freedom to do that. I don't want to do that to my children. I've told my children, I want them to go out there and it doesn't matter what you make. I want you to impact the world. I want you to be a great person. I want you to enjoy and love your life. So I haven't really sat down and read the one last talk, but it's important that we all think about what we're doing.
You just wrote it.
Well, I'm just
there. You're well on your way right now, Gino.
As we're talking about it, it's just emotions are hitting me and I'm thinking about it. And I never said my piece to my dad. I never really sat down.
There's a perception sometimes in the world that when someone passes and we have unspoken words towards them, about them, for them, with them, that ship has sailed, that we don't get that chance anymore. And in some respects, there's a truth to that. I have asked somebody, I don't talk about this in podcasts because people would probably think I'm a complete wacko, but I have encouraged, I would say at this point, maybe 50 different people over the last 5 years to write a letter to, in your case, your dad, sharing what it is you wanted to say X amount of years ago, but never got a chance to share that conversation, to put it in an envelope, to seal the envelope, write his name on it, put whatever address you want on it, and literally go and mail that, put it in the mailbox. And again, I can't tell you on a spreadsheet scientifically, it's going to make a 10% impact in your sense of peace, or it's going to do this, or you're going to lose 5 pounds, or you're going to make 50 million as a I don't know any of that. All I can tell you is this. Not one of those people have come back to me and said, well, that was a useless exercise. Everyone came back and just said, with tears in their eyes or in their voice, thank you for encouraging me to do that, because I have closure now, or a greater degree of closure. So I don't know if that's going to be useful, but it's something I'd highly recommend.
I will. And, you know, you do pray and you do, you know, talk to God, and you make sure that I'm hoping he's going to heaven and all. I know I'm going to see him again. It's just, you know, there are things. And the problem is that he sacrificed so much. And I just want to make sure that he knows that. So, calls to action. Buy the fucking book. Start the work. I never curse. I didn't mean to. Start the work. Get a sheet of paper out. And I think this is an important question, everybody. I wrote this down. What is the most important conversation you're not having? Maybe that's my conversation that I should say to my dad. Man, you're awesome. You gave everything up. And I know you love me and I love you back. And you've done so much and you've impacted my life. You've made the man that I am. I just want to tell you that. That's all.
Guys, we're going to wrap it there. Philip, Gino, thank you guys so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks
for having me on, guys.
It's been an honor and a privilege. I really, really enjoyed the show. Thank you.
Thank you.